The war in Israel, between Israel and Hamas, that has been going on from October 7th, takes its tolls. And the more the time passes, public opinion changes. What are the trends that we see around the world? Does Israel have a chance to stay with the empathy that it received from the West world? And what should we focus on? For that, I'm excited to have Joanna Landau, best-selling author of Ethical Tribing, Connecting the Next Generation to Israel in a Digital Era. And also, she is the founder and president of Vibe Israel. She's a really tremendous person that I'm excited to have. So let's hear what she has to say. Joanna Landau, welcome to Balagan.
Hi, good to see you.
So let's start with a short brief, you know, on what's happening, I would say, in the media, in the world, or in how is Israel portrayed in the world at the moment?
I think we need to understand that there are two main platforms, I guess. One is the traditional media, the other is the social media. They don't necessarily, reflect the same mood of the world. And I think that we give an overdue weight to social media because we see it on our phones and we're very concerned. We're concerned about the young people and so on. The general picture right now is that on the whole, as it was on October 7th, most of the people in the free world, let's call it, the ones whose leadership has to have stood by Israel, when you check public opinion polls and things like that, on the whole, there's more support for Israel still on account of support for, I'm going to say Palestinians, but I don't think that that's the correct terminology anymore because I think we understand that what used to be Palestinians, which were just the Palestinian people, now we're talking about people who even overtly support Hamas, which is, not exactly every single Palestinian supports Hamas. And so it's not really fair, but I'm going to use that as a generalized term. But what we're seeing in most countries is indeed that, you know, anywhere between 60%, 70% more supportive of Israel feel that their own country's interests are being represented in defending the side of that's not the terrorist side. And therefore, when you see public opinion polls, whether it's, France or certainly Germany, United States, even the UK, you'll find that there is support for Israel on account of support for the other side, which is not necessarily what everybody's feeling because there's a tendency to pay attention to the parts of those public opinion that really worry us, which is the young people, which we can talk about later. Then you've got social media. Social media is like the wild, wild west. And one thing that's really important to understand is that there's a massive difference between what we see on our own feeds and what all our friends are talking about and, you know, anecdotal experiences and stories that we hear from people or things that we notice on our own social media feeds and what's really happening as a broad snapshot of all of the world of social media, which is a massive, massive space, right? It's, if social media were a country, it would be probably the third biggest country in the world, right? So I think that we need to understand that we're getting a very warped picture of, what is the situation right now? Because you and I, we're Israeli and we care very strongly about Israel. And therefore, our feed is going to be filled with probably more pro-Israel conversation about the situation and so on. I live in Israel and therefore I'm going to see things going on at home, which is, all the resilience and things like that. But let's say a young woman who's 26 years old who lives in Berlin and isn't Jewish and she's not involved, her feed is going to look completely differently. Certainly we're 3.5 weeks after the events of October 7th. And the same for Sam, who's 22 years old and he lives in Minnesota and he plays football and enjoys having, beers from time to time with his friends. His feed is going to look entirely differently. So we have to understand that giving you a snapshot of the entire, where does Israel stand right now on social media is really almost an impossible answer. I can tell you that at the beginning, I was very interested. I'm very data-driven. So I was very interested in, we're going to search for the keyword Israel on social media platforms, whether it's, X, which is Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and so on, what are we going to see? And what we see is a lot of conversations taking place that are around this topic, but a very, very clear trend towards less and less interaction, meaning less people stopping the scrolling on their phones, paying attention, saying, oh, I like or commenting or sharing. That's interaction. And interaction is an indicator of emotional interest in the story. There's less and less emotional interest in the story that's going on and unfolding in this region around the world. And we can talk about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
In overall or
overall, just on, yes, on this? Yes. Imagine, I think that one of our biggest problems is that we are so involved in the story. Yeah, we're convinced, we always were, by the way, we always convinced that before somebody, when someone wakes up in the morning, before they make their first cup of coffee, they're on CNN and they're on BBC to see what it is that's being said about Israel right now, which of course is not the case, right? But that's what we're like. We, the Israelis, we, the Jews, this is what we do and this is what we're convinced about. And I think that the best way to try and understand how the person that you're hoping to influence, if you're involved in trying to advocate for Israel, how that person feels is if you try to recreate the situation in a way that you're not emotional about it. And what do I mean? I try to imagine, what if this was an event that took place in Guatemala or Nigeria?
Yeah.
Nothing to do with me, nothing to do with the Jews. Like this event happened, horrible slaughter, 1,500 people are dead, 200 and something people have been taken hostage. There's like, there's some terrorists over there. There's the next door neighbors who've got big army. And you know, in the meantime, they're also killing some of the civilians. Like, I don't really understand what's going on over there. What would keep me interested? Like, I think I would probably first couple of days, wow, that's terrible, you know? And then maybe there's like a recipe for a chocolate chip cookie I've been looking for. And then maybe there's something to do with my kids. Yeah. And slowly I'd lose interest, right?
Because you're less involved.
It's because it's just personal. It's not my people. And
exactly.
I think we need to recognize that there are, what, 10 million Israelis and another however million Jews?
Let's say 8 million
in
Jews,
the United States,
give and take.
You know, 6 million Jews, that's what, 2% of Americans? Like, it's not everybody's story.
Right.
And that's that, again, that could be a good or a bad thing. That's that. Then you start thinking strategically about this whole situation. So I'd like to give you a snapshot. I think the most important thing to understand right now, which is actually quite heartening and surprising because we don't feel this way, is that actually most people are either on our side or pretty much on the fence and don't really know. There's a very loud, aggressive, borderline bullying, small minority that is heavily pitched against us, and we have a tendency to pay far more attention to them than to the ones who are with us.
So we are echoing them.
Social media.
We are echoing them in a way.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. There's an element of, you know, when we bring their narrative and we go against it, we're amplifying their narrative.
Right.
Like I always said, you know, when we say Israel is not an apartheid state, what does that actually say about us as Israelis? It says who we're not. It doesn't say who we are. There's a very big difference. That's why I always focused on trying to share Israel's story from who we are as a people. Why should you want to engage with us? What are our strengths? What are our appealing qualities? That's my day job. And then I turn up on October 7th and discover this. And the only difference is that I tend to look at it almost as an outsider. I'm not an Israel advocate by definition, which pretty much most of your audience probably are the same. And I think that if we exercise a little bit of common sense, we'll see that we might be drawn into a conversation that is taking us in the wrong direction, whereas we can be quite strategic about how to get out of the situation in the best possible way.
So technically, from what I hear from you, it sounds like we are in a good standing, as you can say. But
yeah, it's temporary. Yeah.
Living here in New York gives me a different, you know, experience when I see what's happening on college campuses. Now, what's Absolutely. Happening now on Ivy League is insane. And what's happening, you know, with the younger generation, because they actually have, you know, a different conversation going on.
Absolutely.
We just saw Greta Thunberg in Sweden. What can you tell us about Gen
Jewish,
Z?
Jewish students who are pulling her to the side of the, which is very even more disheartening. Absolutely.
And, for that, you have JVP and if
That's
not
what I
now,
mean, yeah.
that...
Very upsetting for anybody who doesn't feel the same way. Look, the story of the next generation, and I wrote an entire book about it called Ethical Tribing, Connecting the Next Generation with Israel in the Digital Era. The story of the next generation has been the writing on the wall for the past decade. This is not new to anybody who's involved in telling Israel's story, even our own next generation, right? This is nothing, there's nothing new here. It just blew up, and it blew up in the least expected places, such as Ivy League campuses, where you'd think that there's a rational thought process where people could not possibly be protesting in the name of Hamas, right? Who just went and murdered.
And justifying massacre.
It's just horrifying. And I, first of all, as an Israeli, okay, I'm living in Israel. Our life is obviously not tremendously uplifting right now. It's very horrible and very harrowing. But my heart goes out to the Jewish people outside of Israel, because I think that the experience that you're having, and you can hear in my voice, I'm originally from England. I don't live in England, and I live in Israel, not just because I love Israel and it's fun and it's a great place and it's cool and all the lovely things that I really, really adore about it. I don't like living in a country where I'm a minority. And so, you know, anti-Semitism was one of the reasons why I you know, continued my parents' decision to leave the country and stay in Israel. And now you're experiencing for the first time an outburst of anti-Semitism, which we don't know and we haven't experienced since, I guess, the Second World War, right? I mean, this is just bizarre. So first of all, I think big embrace and a big empathy to your listeners who might be living around the world as Jews and experiencing a very difficult experience. I totally and fully recognize that you are overwhelmed as well with this sense that the world is against us, with this disappointment in your non-Jewish friends who are not calling to ask you how you are, with the fear of walking around on the streets and Trafalgar Square and Central Station and cities and places around the world where suddenly they're all painted green, red, and white. And it's scary because it's like mob mentality. I fully understand that that is your experience. That's why I always look at data. I always try to understand what's the big picture. Because if I get drawn into the picture that I see, then what actually I'm doing is I'm participating in the psychological warfare of the other side. And this is really what's happening. Major psychological warfare, whether it's with the Israeli public and what Hamas is releasing related to the hostages and statements that are being made that bring a lot of pressure to bear on the government. The government has to make some decisions that are very tough decisions to make relating to the hostages and what we need to do inside Gaza. Or whether it relates to where the Jewish community and the Israelis and the pro-Israel community, what you're doing outside of Israel. And what I would recommend is to look at the bigger picture, to not get drawn into what it feels like, but to have a much more strategic look at this entire thing, because October 7th was an absolute game changer when it comes to Israel's global standing. It's like nothing we've experienced before. Yeah. It's not the same old cycles of violence and so on. Yeah. And one of the first things that I realized on October 7th is if it's like nothing we've experienced before, then we need to think clearly and strategically and recognize that most of what we did until now is irrelevant. We can pull some things that we always knew worked, like, for example, asking, what would you do if it was your kid? That's a very good advocacy tactic, right? Because it puts the onus on the other side to come up with solutions. It's very easy to complain. But if you don't have other solutions, then you realize that this is a very difficult situation. So that's my main message would be to try and recognize that we need to think completely different about this whole thing. We need to look at the data. We need to rationalize this whole situation. It's very difficult to do because we're very, very emotional, but it can be done.
You're saying about what can be done. I want to ask you, I've been working in the past with college students, and I was never a fan, I guess, just like you, of what's called hasbara in Hebrew, or all of the advocacy and, advocacy organizations. I felt that
to your audience, if they don't speak Hebrew, it's very important to understand what the actual core meaning of hasbara is.
Yeah.
It's based on the word explanation, right?
Explanation, exactly.
Right, it's the verb of it's to explain, which by definition, you're like, that means, when do you need to explain yourself? It means you've done something
when
wrong.
When you're not okay, when you're justifying.
Exactly. So semantics sometimes matter. And we begin from a defensive point of view, which is why all of our advocacy efforts for years, if not decades, I think have been misguided to a certain extent. And when I started my activity and my activism in the field, I was going to establish a nonprofit that does advocacy for Israel, because I thought that's what you do. And I stopped for a moment because I come more from the business world and I'm a lawyer, and I could have said, and I was going to put my own money and my own effort into it, my philanthropic activity. And I'm like, okay, if I'm going to put everything into this, I want to understand what my return on my investment is going to be. And I looked in 2010 and I was like, do I think that advocacy and Hasbara for Israel, or Hasbara, is working? Do I feel that, you know, we've got a great image? And my answer, of course, was no. I didn't know what could be done better in the methodology. I kind of felt there's something off with that methodology. But, you know, honestly, I don't even want to argue with anybody. I don't want to debate anyone. I don't want to be right and they're wrong. I just want to build relationships. And so that's why I went to a whole sort of other space of sharing Israel's story, which, like you, is more about, hey, nice to meet you. I'm Israel. Who am I? I'll let you know. Let's see where we can connect. And I went for the positive sort of promotion of Israel. But yeah, Hasbara is an important word to explain, because I think that's the core of where the methodology starts being problematic.
I will say that my podcast is more informal, you know, it's informational. And sometimes I also give my point of view. Yeah. So a lot of times I get backlash from audience. Sometimes if they are lefties, sometimes if they are righties, they're saying, you know, you are slamming Netanyahu, you are this, you are that.
But
I'm telling people, listen, you know, unlike Hasbara, I'm trying to bring you the context of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And if that's reality, then it means that sometimes, you know, not, life is not perfect. Life is not black and white. And it's right everywhere.
I think there's something also, particularly for an audience who's not Israeli. One of the things that I noticed is that Israelis live very comfortably in the gray area, which is not binary, right? It's not this or that. We can somehow live we can like argue with each other and then hug each other. We can hate each other on one thing and love each other on something else. I find that the American psyche is much more comfortable with a binary world. And that's the problem with Israel advocacy, that it can't be binary. It is super complicated. And the other side is very smart about making it binary. You know, they're the good guys, we're the bad guys. It's very, very simple. And we say, no, we're not bad guys. Yes, we do this, but no, we don't do that. But hey, wait a minute, but did you know? And then it gets super complicated and everybody just loses interest, right?
Well, but you can say that the world is always splitting to wars of David and Goliath. You know, that's why it was easy for, you know, the West, for the people, I mean, to identify with the Ukraine against Russia, even though you can say, you know, I don't know, some will say that Russia have some claims, but when it comes to Israel and the Palestinians, for many years, we are the stronger side.
Yeah.
So it's a lot easier. You know, we got used to be the David in the Middle East, but I would say that for ages, you know, for a couple of decades now, we are some sort of a Goliath, even though we don't like it or it's not, but we have the power, and with power comes responsibility.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at it purely from a communication standpoint. We are definitely the Goliath and the Palestinians are the David. There's nothing that we can, you know, nobody can describe it any differently. And the easiest example for that, and you said a couple of decades, it's even longer. If you go on Google and you search for a boy throwing stone at tank, okay, you will find dozens, if not hundreds, of those images, because, by the way, a lot of them are actually doctored, in the sense that, you know, a tank came along during the Intifada and then they'd send a kid, he'd throw the stone, there'd be a photographer behind it, you get the picture. And in that picture, what Israel is saying is that the tank is the victim. Yeah. The tank is David. That's what we're trying to say. And I'm talking about decades ago, okay?
Yeah, I think it's from 2002, from Operation Defensive Shield.
You're right, yeah.
I remember this photo, and I told myself, we're going to lose with this photo.
By definition, we have to recognize that we can try and explain ourselves until we're blue in the face. You cannot come to someone who has Western values, who understands the world through a very, very progressive or even non-progressive, just like, you know, Western viewpoint, that anybody really, a kid throwing a stone at a tank is quite similar to the Chinese guy in Tiananmen Square.
Yeah.
You know, we all know what that was all about. It is what it is, right?
And for our younger audience, in 1989, there was a single protester blocking a full line of T-72 tanks in Tiananmen Square in it was Beijing, if I remember correctly,
somewhere in China.
Shanghai, in China. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows until today, by the way, who was this guy. It's like, it's a
but
jungle.
It was an iconic image showing the difference between, you know, what the... What the government wanted and what the people wanted. And I think that those images are the ones that the other side in our conflict have used tremendously well in their favor. And we spent a long time trying to explain them. And therein lies the problem.
So how do we tackle the conversation? I mean, if we're having all of these, you know, Hasbara issues, and finally, I mean, sadly speaking, we are at this moment, we were the David. Because we were attacked, we were, you know, had a horrible attack by Hamas, murdering, you know, more than 1,500 people. Majority of them are citizens, kids, women, babies, elders. How do you talk about it?
I think it's also important to for the audience to remember we're talking about not just murder and awful, awful, terrible things, but we're talking about, you know, rape and decapitations and just the most terrible things. And by the way, you know, we often forget that it's really not just Israelis there. There are 18 Thai workers who are hostages, who just happen to be there. And
hostages, and I think they're saying like around 50 who were murdered.
Yeah,
I think that
who
about
are agricultural
30
workers.
You know, that they just said that there are almost 200 bodies that will be really hard to identify.
Yeah, we don't know.
The assumption is that around 50 of them are actually Thai workers.
Yeah, yeah. It's just people need to understand that this is one of the things that I would highly recommend is not to focus everything on it being the Jews.
Yeah.
Because this was a crime against humanity. This wasn't a crime against Jews, and it wasn't an anti-Semitism per se event. It was a crime against humanity event of Islamic extremism that wants to actually take over the world and turn it into one big massive caliphate. And everybody is an infidel. The Jews, of course, but so are the Christians and so is anybody else that isn't. So let's go back to basics. And I think that when you deal with a situation like this, you have to recognize what happened on October 7th in order to know where to go from here. And from my this is my understanding, and I've been presenting this and whoever, you know, feels the same way, great. And whoever disagrees, it's also fine. it's a strategy that I'd like to propose, okay? It begins with looking at what happened on October 7th. On October 7th, two things happened. October 7th, 8th, 9th happened simultaneously that haven't happened since the establishment of the State of Israel. The first thing is that Israel became the victim. Unequivocally, clearly, with no doubt who was right and who was wrong, at no level, forget what happened afterwards where they said, well, you know, 75 years of occupation, this is what happened.
Definitely.
Okay, but by definition, when you go and you slaughter 1,500 people in their homes and you rape and you pillage and you take 200 and something hostages, by definition, there's one side who's the David and the other side who's the Goliath in this very weird, odd situation. So first of all, Israel is the victim. It reclaimed the victim narrative that it used to have during the Holocaust and where after the state was established, okay? And it lost it when the Palestinian cause became stronger and stronger over time, okay? Since the, you know, 70s and later, okay? So for the first time, Israel reclaimed the victim of the narrative. That's massive. It's no small thing. Everybody can now say, yeah, but then we lost it once we started bombing and whatever. Just a minute, okay? Before we get there. The second thing that happened on around the same day or two is that all of the leaders of the free world, practically all of them, stood by Israel's side and declared that it's absolutely unacceptable what happened and we support Israel. And, you know, the leading one being Biden, who really put all of his eggs in the basket of supporting Israel. But we're talking about Schultz in Germany and Sunak in England and Macron in France and Trudeau in Canada and, you know, leaders of countries that haven't even been on our side for years, the EU, you know, different things like that. I'm putting aside the UN, which is, of course, always a complicated place. And you recognize that these two things happening simultaneously are the biggest game changers since the establishment of the State of Israel in terms of our global standing and understanding of who the Israeli people are. By the way, sadly, really sadly, one of the ways of getting to know Israelis was through the stories of the people who were there. The fact that it happened at a dance festival that was celebrating peace and all these beautiful young men and women who only went there to dance showcases our Western values and our shared values with Americans and with people around the world. Something that we haven't done well enough. We've said it, but we haven't shown it enough over the years. So first of all, we understand that those two big things happened. And under those circumstances, the question is, how did the world respond? So I look at data. And I looked at, and I always looked at data, which is why this was what I was doing before. And I recalled suddenly that I had these, snapshots of Gallup polls and Pew polls and all these famous polls that we keep on looking at, YouGov and Ipsos and all these different polls that anybody's involved in Israel's image looks at. And I remembered a snapshot of one from Gallup where you see 2002 all the way through 2022, where you see sympathy for Israel versus sympathy for the Palestinians. And I pulled it out of my computer. And what I saw was, and I remembered suddenly, that in the United States, differently to what everybody's feeling right now, for the last 20 years, there has always been significantly more support, at least double support for Israel compared to the Palestinians. Okay. First of all, doesn't feel that way. But it always was that way. Anywhere between 60, 55, 70% support for Israel, 15 up to 20, up to 25, maybe on a bad day, 28% support Palestinians. And then you had, starting in 2002, about a third of Americans who really didn't know and didn't care. And 2022 was around a quarter of them. Okay. But on the whole, more support for Israel, less support for the Palestinians significantly. And a worrying trend of growing support for the Palestinians, which is especially coming from the younger generation. This is a snapshot that anybody in the world of Israel advocacy recognizes and knows and is familiar with. And then I thought, interesting, let's see what happened today, right? This was post October 7th. I think it was October 16th. CNN did a poll where it said, ask the same question, who do your sympathies lie with? And I know I saw a very strange thing, or not strange. 61% support Israel. That's an increase of 6% from 2022. Massive drop in support for the Palestinians, like 13%, I don't even remember. And then somewhere in the middle, again, like 25% back in the middle. Don't really know. And I look at that and I'm thinking, strange, that's not what I feel. It's not what I see on my social media, right? So then I pulled content from the UK. I looked at public opinion polls from the UK. I remembered I had a snapshot of the last 5 years. 10% support for Israel, very low. 27% support for the Palestinians. So also not that high. Not good, but not that high. And then 60-something percent who don't care in the UK, which is the centerhold of the BDS movement. Fast forward to October 16 or whenever it was, YouGov polls. Now we've got double support for Israel, 21% support for Israel, decrease of about 17% support for the Palestinians from 20-something percent, much lower, and then 62% who just don't know. So what I realized is that actually we had this blip in history where something happened, it got the world's attention, it got the empathy on our side, but then right now we're in a situation where the public opinion polls are better for us than they were before. And if they continue being this good, this is all we need. We don't need the whole world to agree with us. If we've got what I call the silent majority, meaning those who are really with us, plus the 60-odd percent who don't really care, who are not pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian, right. Actually, that is going to come through in the opinion polls. And really, who do we want to influence right now? And who do we want to impact? And who do we want to protect right now? It's actually the nation's leaders who have decided to be on Israel's side. The Bidens of the world, the Macron, the Sunak, these are the people who are literally sending us warships and money and ammunition. Israel can't win this war without their help. Okay, we're like whoever saw Golda And she's on the phone with Kissinger.
With Kissinger.
And she's saying, send us the planes. Like, if we didn't have the planes, we wouldn't win the war, right? Right. Same situation right now. We're a very strong army, but no army can handle this situation. So we need the support of allies. So what you recognize is public opinion doesn't win wars and public opinion doesn't extract hostages. Governments do that and armies. And what we need to do right now as an objective of the communication strategy is to mitigate the situation, to contain the situation, not to amplify this conversation so that everybody agrees with us. I don't need everybody to agree with us. All I need is that when public opinion polls come along, they say, do you think it's in the UK's interest to keep on fighting Hamas? Do you think it's in American interest to do what we're doing in the United States? As long as they say, yes, I do think that's a good idea, that's what Biden's looking at. He's not looking at his campaign for re-election until a year from now. And that's very important for us to understand. We worry tremendously about the kids on campus and what's going on and the pressure on the Democrats and all these different things. But we have to remember that campaigns for presidency don't happen a year before. They happen leading up to the to the elections. So when we think about the strategic objective, it's very different from what it's always been. In the past, Hasbara was all about how do we get more and more people on Israel's side to actively be on Israel's side, to take our side. There are, you know, there are organizations that have the term stand with, you know, Israel in their name, okay, which is totally understandable and commendable. But it's not necessarily what we need right now. Right now, we just need the silent majority to stay put and be comfortable where they are and not be drawn into a narrative that they can't turn their backs on, which is the poor woman coming out of the rubble in Gaza with her, dead baby. And this is the Palestinian story. This is the narrative that they're pushing. So first of all, the objective is different. The objective is to make sure that the global leaders do not pull their support from Israel. The only way that they will do that, because it's totally in their interest to help us, because they understand that there are terror cells in every one of their countries as well. I mean, 9/11 didn't come out of nowhere. Okay, this is 20 years in the making, okay? Yeah. They are here because it's in their interest. They're not helping the Jews, they're helping themselves. But if they get a lot of pressure from public opinion, they're going to have a little bit of a problem managing it. So our objective is to protect the global leaders. Who's our target market? Which is the second part of a strategy. It's what I call the silent majority. In Israel, sometimes we call them the gray people, the ones who are not active or the ones who are already on our side. You know, there's the ones who are very, very much against us. I personally think they're a waste of energy. I think that their whole effort right now is to reclaim the narrative. And therefore, if they manage to pull us into a conversation which is just about them, then we're again missing the opportunity to tell our story and to provide an alternative narrative that can sit well with this silent majority. And that brings me to the narrative. When we tell Israel's story, and when we have told Israel's story for the last 20 odd years, it's always been in the context of the narrative that was defined by the Palestinians. No, we're not an apartheid state. Well, you have to understand it's complex. Well, you know, the settlement's okay, yes, but, you know, all of our yes, but, or no, and that kind of thing. Very rarely did we come along with our own narrative where we defined the conversation, not somebody else, and we're responding to it. And there's a very well-known way of thinking from the advertising world. It's actually a statement that was made by Don Draper in Mad Men, in one of the episodes of Mad Men, right? But he said, when you don't like what's being said, change the conversation, right? You can't go into the conversation that is being said that's negative about you and try to respond, because you're likely coming from a very reactive, very underdog in terms of the conversation position. If you create a whole new conversation and a new narrative, it's much easier for you to sway the ones who are on the fence into the narrative that you want them to talk about and not back to the narrative that the Palestinians want you to talk about. So what is a narrative that can be something that the silent majority will come across and feel comfortable enough embracing? There are several narratives going on right now. And by the way, I actually checked them in terms of research that was done. One of them is the traditional advocacy narrative, which is 4,000 rockets have fallen on us today. This is the amount of people who've been injured. this is the amount, you know, very factual, very numeric even. That kind of narrative used to be kind of honestly ineffective. It's slightly more effective these days, but not like it's the least effective of all the narratives that we can use. You've then got the narrative of the terrible things that happened on October 7th. And I would split that into two, one being the really awful gore snuff images, which are like, you know, violent, violent porn, okay? Like the blood and the decapitations and all these things that were shown in the first few days. I would not recommend promoting content like that. The reason being that this is exactly what Hamas wants us to do. They published it. Clearly, they want someone to distribute it, and we did that for them. Now, it's important for the world to see it. However, the best way for the world to see it is if it's given to journalists who need to live up to certain standards of journalism where they have to, you know, blur the images that are too painful right. to see. They have to present it as part of some contextual image. That is definitely something that can be shared, but I would share it in a very, 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 very careful manner, because while it's effective to show the world how awful the story was, nobody goes onto social media to see pictures of dead babies. You just don't share it. It's just not content that people want to share, and people, you know, they don't go onto Instagram to see someone who's raped. It's just not the content to do that. And then you've got the stories, of course, the personal, emotional stories of the victims, which is very powerful. But still, when you think about October 7th, it happened 3.5 weeks ago in terms of news cycle. It's over. And you can still, if you're a pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas, you can say, yeah, well, you know, after 75 years of apartheid and occupation, don't be surprised that these freedom fighters ended up doing these. Yes, they're terrible things, but, you know, and bringing you back to their narrative. There's only one narrative which works for us. And I say this again with the deepest discomfort, because everything is horrible. But the story of the hostage crisis is the real story that we can and should use as the narrative that we promote when talking about this horrible situation. And I'll explain. First of all, it's an emotional story, so people want to share it. It's something that there are really amazing stories of beautiful people that very easily relatable. Okay, they're really people just like anybody else. Babies, beautiful gingerhead baby, Fir, and a beautiful young girl called Amalia, and another girl who's autistic, and a grandmother, and the young girl that we saw, Noah, being taken on the motorbike, which looks like a scene in Fauda, right? It's like crazy. And you see her, and she's so beautiful. And her father is so touching when he speaks, and her mother is Chinese. And you're like thinking, hey, that's confusing. I thought everybody in Israel was Jewish. You know, it confuses the audience, right? So those emotional stories are very powerful. And the most important part about it are two things. One is that anybody, certainly in the Western world, has seen this story before and not from Israel. They've seen it on every TV series and in every movie. Hostage crisis is something which is very, very known. Okay, it's not something that we need to teach anyone about. Right. In the hostage crisis, you have the bad guys who take the hostages. In our case, how bad are they? They're ISIS bad. Right? Yeah. That's how bad they are. But by definition, they're bad. And on the other side, you've got the good guys who are coming to save them, the Navy SEALs, the James Bonds of the world, the IDF. They're the good guys by definition. And unfortunately, people will die in the process of trying to extract these hostages. And that will happen, and some of them will be innocent. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible situation, but it's something that the Western world is fairly familiar with, and that's why it's a very powerful story. But the most powerful aspect is that it's not asking a person who's on the fence, who is presented by the mother with a baby on the other side and the Palestinian narrative, we're not asking them to take a side if they care for hostages. That is a huge, huge difference to every other narrative that we have. By caring and wanting to help extract young men, women, babies, and elderly people in the middle of a horrible, horrible place that's surrounded by terrorists who are horrible to their own citizens as they are to everybody else, that's not asking somebody to say, I don't care about Palestinian innocent civilians. And that's a very, very powerful narrative to use. So right now, so long as we have civilian hostages, because unfortunately, once they're, it's only soldiers, then people don't care about soldiers because they are part of the war.
In Israel, I would argue that sometimes soldiers' blood is thicker than civilians' blood.
Even worse, no, for sure. But when you see, it's interesting, you know, in the, 10 years ago or so, when people used to start, were coming back from the Gulf, from Afghanistan or from wherever it is that American soldiers left. And then they came back home and you saw all these lovely images of people dressed up at some event, and suddenly they take off their costume and it's their kid sees them and they're like, oh my God, dad, and whatever. That humanized the soldier, right? A soldier is a machine of war. Okay. And suddenly Americans started to see soldiers as you know, parents and loved ones and so on. And for us in Israel, you know, my son's a combat soldier. I don't know where he is right now. I know he's fighting. I'm very worried. You know, I don't know. He's my son, right? And it's national conscription. Okay. And it's very, very scary. But I can't expect a woman in Amsterdam to understand how I feel, because I don't think they have national conscription there. And therefore, it's my son is a soldier. He's just a soldier to her, right? So I think that that's the so long as there are civilian hostages, the narrative in terms of communications strategy is that's a very powerful narrative to use. And whenever you post something or you enter into a conversation, pulling it into that conversation, that messaging, and telling the story of one out of the 220 something is always much more powerful, by the way, than saying there are 220 or 230 something people that are still in there. If you tell one person's story and then say there are 220, 238 more, that's a much more powerful way of connecting people emotionally. But that's the big picture. The objective is to protect the politicians who've made a choice to be on Israel's side. They look at public opinion polls. So we don't need everybody to agree. Okay, it's okay. But as long as they don't get drawn into the other narrative, we're fine. The audience is the silent majority. Those who are already with us, we need to give them a big hug and thank them for being with us. The celebrities who stood by our side, like, sending them DMs. Thank you so much for, you know, supporting. I loved you always and I love you now even more, that kind of stuff. And then, of course, the ones who are not really interested, tell stories of the hostages, personal stories. It's very difficult to be cold to that. And as long as that's the case, I think we'll be fine. The situation is better than we think. We will need a new narrative once there are no more civilian hostages, and that will probably sit on the space of good versus evil, where, you know what, free Palestine? Sure, let's free Palestine. But free Palestine means
Hamas.
Ending Hamas, right? That's what it means. And if we created this humanitarian corridor, we told people to move to the south of Gaza, and in the south of Gaza, we're giving them humanitarian aid. We're going to be building a field hospital that Israel knows how to do best in all the world. It always has done. And we show our compassion. We show our Western values. We show that we are real people that really just care to live in a world of peace and serenity for everybody. Then maybe people will start understanding that in a war, bad things happen. And it's terrible, terrible. But we need to lead with empathy, recognize the difficulty of a person who's not in our condition, to feel empathy for the other side, not negate it, not tell them they're wrong, not get angry at them, embrace them, empathize, and go with our own narrative.
Joanna, I have a lot more questions to you, I got to tell you. I have actually more questions than answers, but it's going to go for the long term. So yeah. I really want to thank you for this conversation. Sadly, you know, it's hard to be in a situation that you always think if they are with us or against us. And I really hope, you know, really pray for better days in Israel. I really hope that this war will end soon and that our...
For everybody,
you know, our hostages will be home soon.
I do want to say just a last statement. The story of the next generation is something that absolutely needs to be dealt with. It absolutely does. It's a long term.
Yes, definitely.
We need to deal with it. I would implore the Jewish people outside of Israel to be much more aggressive about it. I have friends in the UK and they're talking about their kids at universities. And I imagine that if I were there, I literally would get buses of, seriously, this is what I do, okay? If I had a kid on a university right now, I would hire a bus of 50 people. I would invite anybody who is an alumni, a donor, or a parent or brother or sister or child of a student or faculty member of that university get on the bus every single day, turn up on campus and knock on doors and understand who is taking care and making sure that my Jewish kid feels safe on campus.
Yeah.
That's all I care about right now. Not Israel, Palestine, whatever. If there is a dean of a university who is incapable of living up to their own charter of safety for all of their students on campus, this is unacceptable and I will make their life a living nightmare. Every day of people turning up, we have to, the whole writing letters and complaining and having meetings, and let's be a little bit Israeli about it. Right? Seriously, I'm not joking. And if there are some Israelis there who want to do the initial push and the initial running into the then do it together with the Jewish community. The Jewish community has been amazing. You've been, you know, the amount of money that's been raised to help. Unbelievable. It's so needed. It's so needed. But right now you also need to take care of your own, and you might need to take the gloves off and be a little bit more aggressive about it.
I will say that they do it in different platforms. I can tell you that when the Jewish mom needs to stand up, she stands up. So
absolutely. Good. Well, that's what we need to do.
Yeah.
No, the situation is totally unacceptable. And I totally, with you, feel it's like 1933 or later, Germany. I mean, it's just not right what's going on and unacceptable. And people need to be accountable for that. And, we're not going to let this happen again. We're just not. And we will win this war. That's the most important piece.
Well, we have to.
We will. We will. We have to. Israel will rebuild itself. We will come out of this. I call it a sad silver lining. It's a very sad silver lining. This war has done terrible, terrible things, but it's reconnected internally, the Jewish people and the Arabs and the, all the different parts of Israel. It's reconnected Jewish diaspora with Israel.
Yeah, it's an opportunity it's definitely an opportunity here.
Yeah. We just have to stay optimistic. We're the Jews know how to do that.
Yeah.
We do. We've been around for a few thousand years.
Yana, with this positive message, I'm going to thank you very much for joining me today and for enlightening our audience. And we'll definitely have a conversation after the war about what to do in the long term.
Yeah,
because there is a lot to be done.
There's a lot to be done. It's just that that's not the most important.
It's not the time.
Yeah. Oh, we can do both. There are lots of people.
That's true.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.